It's Wednesday, April 16th. This is The Job. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
I'm here with Candace Briglib. We were at TEDx this weekend. Did you have fun?
I did, yeah.
I really enjoyed.
I always like those.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is our, was it fourth year?
Fourth year? Yeah. 4 of 4, perfect score.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite talk? Sorry about my slurping.
Favorite talk? Oh, that's so hard. I'm going to say Nong's talk was, so she has a food cart here in town, and phenomenal food. And I think just hearing her story sort of blew me away. And it was, I would say, a favorite because it was the first time of the day that I cried. Not the last, but it was just really moving, her story.
It was great.
Yeah. She's a really hard worker and, you know.
No kidding.
She's making it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
Sometimes
super
I think.
Nice, too, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No. It reminded me, this isn't super topical, but it reminded me of this story of this woman that was helping helping women out. I think probably, I don't know where I heard it, but she was helping people that had been in like war-torn countries. And long story short, she teaches them to give people pedicures. And you wonder, like, why do pedicures matter? But it's like the first time that a lot of them had like touched someone else, touched their feet, had looked at somebody in the eye and like smiled at them. And actually, like, it totally transformed their lives. And it became this amazing nonprofit. And I was thinking about with Nong about sometimes it's really easy to discount how important food is.
Yeah.
Things. And her story was just really inspirational to me because, you know, she didn't have the best childhood growing up, but she took something from her childhood that was really positive, which was food that she loved. She brought it over with her, and she's using it to not just support herself, but also to bring, you know, joy to other people. And as you saw when we visited her cart even before TED, I mean, I can't remember a time that I went up to a food cart and left laughing. Like, everyone there was in such a good mood, and they were really into what they were doing. You could tell they were really happy, and the food made you feel good. And, you know, it just kind of was a good thing.
Let's see if I could get her to be on this show.
Do
I would
it.
Love to talk to her. She's just so cool. You know, I was thinking about doing this recording last night, and I find myself getting really, and this is also, we're just going to be all over the place this morning with our conversation, but I find myself really upset when I buy an album off from Apple, for example, that doesn't have really good artwork.
Yes.
And also, if I do it reluctantly because I'm just so much happier with a record, it's just they're not very portable and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I was pulling out this REM record just now before we went in here, Fables of the Reconstruction. And that band influenced me as much musically as they did in graphic design and the work that I do, because I'm always so interested in. Like, if you take the sleeve out, it's so playful. There's just, like, this collage that sets an atmosphere on the inside and, like, lists the song titles. And they're always very playful. Like, it says Fables of the Reconstruction. But then if you turn the outside of the record over, it says Reconstruction of the Fables. And they were always doing playful things with hiding messages in their sleeves and hiding things in the design. And I remember thinking, I was trying to think of, how does responsive design compare, like, what parallels are there to actual real-world design? And I thought of one.
Mm-hmm.
Cassette tapes. Because records and CDs, they always had square artwork. But in the early 80s, what I bought was cassette tapes. And every single one, they had to customize the artwork for this completely different format. And I remember being fascinated by, like, whose job that was and how they made those decisions. And some of them did a really shitty job. And some of them did, like, a really cool job. And I felt like some people designed their album covers so they could work that way. And I was thinking about how much that is like responsive design now. In fact, holding a cassette cover, it's like the same form factor as an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm tempted to buy some cassettes just to show them to the team next to the records. Like, look at this difference.
Like the record that you were just talking about, can you get the cassette from that?
Well, they have a ton of them down at the record store up the street. They just have this pile of cassettes. And I was thinking, like, I own half of these records. I should buy some of these cassettes just to look at the...
Did you?
No. Oh. I'm going to go do it after this. Anyway.
You just drop the mic and run out. Done. Yes.
Yeah. Today's guest is Alicia Rose.
Do you know something? So Alicia is a talented photographer, and she's working on a video right now for Bob Mould.
Bob Mould, one of my heroes. I mean,
how more impressive can that be?
None more impressive.
But I was doing a little research, and I realized that I have been missing meeting Alicia for about a year and a half because we both attend the same Game of Thrones viewing night
at
mutual friends.
Do you just go on opposite?
Yes. I was doing a little research for her name, and it kept coming up at this event that I was invited to. And there's only like, you know, 9 or 10 people invited. It's not like this huge, big event. But anyway, so that was kind of funny.
Wow, what are the odds?
Yeah.
Huh. That's her excuse. She doesn't have kids.
Well, I think I've been following her on Facebook, and the last time that I went to it, I pulled up or her Instagram or something, and it looked like she was in a helicopter looking down on Portland or like really eating somewhere high up. So I thought, oh, that might be a little more fancier than watching Game of Thrones in small.
Yeah.
Anyways.
This week, Alicia.
I feel like we're finally going to converge in the same way.
I'm sure if you said that you were going, she would go.
I'm going.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk to Alicia.
Let's do it.
Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Raymond.
So, The Gift of Gravity just premiered the other day.
Yeah.
Presently. How did that go?
You know, I was really nervous.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever been so nervous ever in my life
when
it comes to premiering something in front of people, because this particular film was such a roller coaster, and it really is like an emotional story. I mean, it is and it isn't. It's really fun, and then you're like, holy crap.
Mm-hmm.
I just got, you know, whipped through the blender. And that was part of what I wanted to do, which is a fairly bold thing, I'm finding out, for a first narrative short after watching 60 films this weekend, which, you know, the vibe of a lot of those films, it's almost like, you know, test pilot for a web series. It just all, everything feels very pat, though there were some fun moments. My film is not like that. My film is 15 minutes and it's its own little tiny film, or ostensibly could be the beginning of a feature film where it leaves you on this question, and it's got an intense little arc. It's just, and it's very stylistic and aesthetically oriented because that's how my brain rolls. But to answer your question, it was received very well, which was amazing, and I was super psyched. But I've never been so nervous, especially in the context of everything else I saw. I was like, what are people gonna think of this? This is crazy.
Right. Did you, how long have you been working on this?
Well, we started talking about the idea last January. I think I had written the initial script by March. And we started workshopping with the actresses around that time. And then I kind of tied the script down by May. We shot it in May. And then we started editing after we shot it kind of in June, and realized pretty quickly that I needed some more stuff to fill out the story, which is pretty typical for any film you make. There's always going to be pickups and something you're like, oh, yeah, there's a hole. I'm going to fix that before the light has changed, summer.
Right.
So we did some pickups in August and then kind of had all the pieces, and then pretty much took another 4 or 5 months to edit it. We really wrapped it in December, like early December.
Okay.
And then really, really wrapped it with credits and everything like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. So were you planning, how long has it been that you were planning to show it at this festival?
Well, we only found out we got into PowFest, you know, toward the beginning of the year. It was like in January. Then we kind of knew we'd have to just tighten up the cut and get them a final version. But it was a very successful screening. Even, I mean, it was, we sold out the small theater, and so they moved us to the big theater, and that was cool. And people were really enthusiastic. It was interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fun.
So where does this go from here?
Well, you know, short films are interesting. We're submitting it to loads of festivals. So we just ran a successful Indiegogo, which was cool. And so we're submitting to a bunch of different festivals. We've submitted to some, haven't gotten into a handful. Hopefully we'll get into a handful over the course of the year. You know, because it's different. And this is, of course, my opinion, being the filmmaker, having, you know, and also a fan of films and having just watched a whole weekend's worth of films at PowFest, which was pretty cool. You know, I think it isn't like everything else, which is going to be good or bad. I mean, I have a definite point of view, and coming from a place where I've developed a visual style over the past 4 or 5 years, and mm-hmm. even before that as a photographer. So, you know, it's going to take the right festival to be like, oh wow, this is different, let's go for it. But because it's also slightly difficult subject matter, where it deals with, you know, bullying and abuse and some things that aren't exactly just like, woohoo, let's watch a short film kind of material,
right.
I think it makes it a little more challenging to program. But at the same time, I mean, I had 15 people come up to me and tell me that they were moved and that they cried, and I'm like, oh my god, right, I've watched it so many times I forgot that's what it did to right. me when I first yeah. watched it, you know. So I don't know, I mean, I wanted to make a film that was about these young women who kind of take you with them on this really natural like ride in the beginning of their day, and then kind of do some bad things. They smoke some pot, they drink some energy drinks, and then they, because, you know, energy drinks are really the evil. It's not the pot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's never nowadays. The pot. It's always the Red Bull. and they decide to bully an ex-friend, and they get into trouble, and, you know, they witness some really hard stuff. So it's an interesting film. I'm really excited about it. I love it. I also didn't pull any punches. You know, I made it, you know, an intense little film that isn't a pat Lifetime story. I wanted to make something beautiful and challenging and transformative, and also leave it open on a question of what do we do if we, you know, make bad choices and happen to capture this terrible scene with our phones. We're sitting on this video, which is really the essence of where the film winds up.
Let's take a step back.
Yes, I talked. I put a lot in there.
No. That's great. That's great. I wanted to lead with that. But now let's talk about where are you from?
Originally Los Angeles, but then San Francisco. And then I moved here to Portland in 1995.
Okay.
I've lived here longer than where I grew up. So am I a native-ish? Native-ish Portlander? I don't know. 95, I've seen some shit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you have. Yeah, you've seen some of the worst of Portland. So,
and some of the best.
How long have you been doing like photography?
Well, you know, I started doing photography at the same time that I started playing music as an accordion player and mm-hmm. making, like, doing all of that, and also working in the music business, all like pretty much around 1990.
Okay.
And then kind of, you know, even though I learned how to do filmmaking in high school and in college, that's what I went to school for, music became much more interesting. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I also was focused on photography. So I kind of let go of the idea of directing and filmmaking at a really young age, because growing up in Los Angeles, I was just like, I don't want to be a part of that. And it mm-hmm. really is still that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, of course, good things in LA. I can't say it's all bad. But because I gave that up, I kept doing photography, because when I'm working in the music business and working with all these bands, it always seemed to come up as a need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just around people. Oh, can you take pictures? Yeah. And I learned how to use a darkroom when I was 20. And, you know, ultimately was booking clubs in San Francisco. I booked a club called The Chameleon. And one of my conditions for booking the club was having a darkroom in the basement.
Okay.
And she said, yes, and I said yeah, and then I developed all my own black and white, printed, and worked with lots of bands even then in the 90s. And then when I moved here, worked in music distribution at a company called Nail that I ultimately became president of, which seems crazy now, but that's how it was. And then got out of that and started booking clubs again here, and that is when I kind of got back into photography. So there was a time when it wasn't as, I mean, I was still doing it. I mean, I started mm-hmm. shooting the Decembers, for example, in 2000 when I was working at Nail, and shot their Picaresque album cover and like 10 other shoots for them that were kind of helped define their whole thing up mm-hmm. until they got signed to Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think working with them actually was one of the more interesting and sort of illuminating moments of working with a band, where I thought, wow, okay, not only do I, of course, love doing this, which I had been loving before, but they just, Colin and I at the time had this collaboration. It was really fun. And I realized that, you know, it was a natural thing for me to tell stories while taking pictures. And then that just kind of snowballed. And so I started doing more and more photography and working with just loads of bands. I mean, I've shot hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bands now, and I've loved it. And at the time, primarily I was working in film. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've switched over to digital since and have, because of that, have gotten more into directing. And that happened around 2008 when I started getting more into directing.
Okay. Why accordion?
Why not? You know, the accordion it was so just kismetic and it made so much sense to me. I grew up, like I said, in Los Angeles, in a very kind of Jewish, iconoclastic, strange, weird little family, and almost everybody played an instrument. And I tried with all my heart to play all kinds of instruments. And really, I tried piano and I got it, but I wasn't that excited about it. Guitar, bass, I sucked at both of those. I started singing, I could do that. But, you know, I felt really like a fish out of water with my family. And I left LA, then went to school in San Francisco and started working as a barista at a small kind of music / laundromat called Brainwash on Folsom, okay. South of Market. And one day, this band, Joseph something, I can't remember his name, but he had this accordion. And I was just literally a barista. I just saw his accordion. I was like, that is the coolest thing I have ever seen in my life. He let me play it that day. I asked him, how do I do this? He goes, well, strap it on and feel the buttons. You feel an indentation on the left-hand side, and that's middle C. And then everything kind of moves around middle C. And I was like, oh. So I did indeed press middle C with my middle finger. That's what you're supposed to do. It sounds dirty, but it's really not. And then you pull, you engorge the lungs of the accordion. I'm making it sound really saucy.
Yeah, you are.
I'm trying to get people
just
to
change the rating of this podcast.
More pro accordion. You strap it on, and then you slip your hand underneath the sort of the strap on the bass side, and you just tenderly reach your fingers around until you depress middle C with your middle finger, and then you pull your arm out, and all of a sudden it makes this big bellowing gorgeous sound, and then you play melody on the right side with your hand, with your right hand. And I don't know, immediately it started making sense to my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like no other instrument had. And I think I loved the portability and the absurdity and the oft maligned aspect of it, because mm-hmm. I'm not someone who, you know, who doesn't take a challenge. I like things being a little different, a little difficult. I don't like to give people just what they expect and flop it out and something that doesn't make me excited. I want to be excited. And then if I'm excited, I want to share. So I got really excited about the accordion, took a few lessons from like this cute Italian man in like Burlingame or something in San Francisco. And I learned enough, and I was involved in this music scene because I was booking nightclubs. At that point, you know, I played for like a year when I was 19 to 20 and just had a good time learning. And then I started booking the Chameleon by the time I was 21. And the next thing I know, you know, I had my accordion with me because I was practicing all the time. And Lee Joseph from Hell Yeah Records did a show there that I booked. And he's like, what are you up to these days? Oh, I've got this accordion I'm obsessed with and I'm playing all the time. He's like, we should put out a single someday. And I said, haha, that's crazy. And then, you know, 6 months later, I was like, wow, somebody offered me recording time and wanted me to play on one of their recordings, and I'd been writing songs. So I had these songs, and I said, Lee, do you want to put these songs out? And he did, and that was in 91. And then I made 1, 2, 3, 4 albums, and all kinds of crazy stuff happened. But who knew?
Uh-huh.
The accordion.
The accordion. The oft-maligned accordion.
The oft-maligned squeeze box. Now I play the drums, believe it or not. I don't really even touch my accordion. I've been really into playing the drums. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. So was it hard for you, maybe emotionally rather than the actual act, to switch to doing digital photography rather than film?
It was definitely, I don't know. I mean, I'm still in the middle of that transition. Yes and no. I mean, because of digital, it really made the reality of creating music videos on lower budgets absolutely like palpable. It was immediate. It was like, okay, now we can actually, I own the camera. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And of course, now I make videos with much fancier cameras that I don't own because I can't help myself. And I know amazingly talented cinematographers. However, at the time, having access to something you owned or that your friend owned, and that it wasn't such a hassle just to try to get to make this video, you know, that was incredible. And that was the beginning of when I started getting super psyched on digital. And I kept shooting film the whole time. I still have my Hasselblad and I still shoot with it. But you know, when you, it really got bad when I bought my 5D Mark III and realized, wow, you know, with programs like Lightroom, the efficiency and the amount of photos I can take, it's just, I mean, it's liberating to mm-hmm. be able to take 1,000 photos in 2 hours mm-hmm. versus, or for me, it's more like an hour, maybe half an hour. It's tragic. I'm just like, oh, it's like, I'm probably overdoing it these days because I just am so excited that I could keep going. Where with film, you know, you have only so many rolls of film. If you're right. lucky, a shoot can afford 10 rolls. This is with an indie, whatever, whomever I'm working with. And then you're processing and developing, getting it scanned, and then working with it in Photoshop after that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I learned really how to shoot on a square. That's my brain. And so, you know, but I think I've done well with digital. I mean, it's working out. I've done some beautiful stuff and I definitely feel like I've figured it out and I love it. And it's so nice to have the flexibility. And, you know, I've done some pretty nice, high profile, gorgeous stuff. It just comes down to the same things that it did with film. You know, what's your light like? What's your subject? You know, how are you engaging with the person that you're photographing or the environment? And, mm-hmm. you know, how does it all gel and come together? And then the technical stuff is really, you know, the stuff that you don't talk about that you're just doing while you're taking those photos. It's the camera is really just, you know, the filter in between you and the subject.
What was the first music video that you did, and how did that come about?
Loch Lomond okay. for Blue Lead Fences. Well, they, like many bands that I had been working with over the years doing photography for, mm-hmm. were like, okay, when are you going to start making music videos? Because really, like, your photos are like stills from music videos. So what the age? Richie, I think, was a person who said that to me and was like, come on. And he was the first person where, I don't know, I felt like I could do a video for them. I had a really strong idea and I don't know. It worked out because I was booking Doug for, I think at this point I can say that I helped them get a show, like some private show where they got paid $1,000. Then we took that and made that the music video budget.
Okay.
And we bought all the Super 8 film and, you know, just made a Super 8 video for them. And that was interesting and challenging in and of itself. And it had its own vibe because it was Super 8.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you take the Super 8 film, you get that scan, you edit in Final Cut. And that's what we did. And his brother, Dusty, helped me edit that one. It was really fun. And, you know, I had no expectations at that point. I just was psyched to do it. And it came out quite well. It had a really interesting vibe and it did well. And then mm-hmm. that led to the next one and then the next one and the next one. And now I've made like 24 of them, of traditional music videos and many more other kinds of videos.
Mm-hmm. So you've been doing that for maybe 5 years?
Since the end of 2008.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after I left Doug Fir, I went to Mississippi Studios and I was there for a while as owner and booker, one of the owners and partners. And I did a few more there. I did the Builders and Butchers video there and a few others. And then when I left Mississippi Studios, I went on unemployment and then I made it my mission to make as many music videos as I possibly could mm-hmm. while on unemployment, mm-hmm. thinking this is my NEA grant. I'm never going to get a chance again yeah. to go in and like just kill it. So many one after the other. So I made like 10 in a year or something okay. like that. It was crazy. I came off that and then wanted to focus more on narrative. And now I'm kind of coming back into the balance of doing them all. I'm working on a few videos now.
Mm-hmm. So how do you shoot videos now that might be different than, you know, 2008? I mean, obviously you're not using Super 8.
Well,
or are you?
Well, if I had the cause to do it, I would. I love yeah. Super 8. And I would love to shoot 16 or 35 at some point. I mean, do it my way, you know, mm-hmm. really utilize that film. I would it would rip it up. I would love to do that. But budgets don't really allow for that. And really, you know, as a filmmaker, you want to have enough chances to be successful at a shot, and sometimes film won't allow you to do that. You know, it's nice to have digital to allow you to sort of experiment in the moment, and I like doing that on my videos. So
you feel digital just lets you be a little more spontaneous.
You can just keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, with film, you can't. You're done. Right. Oops, all yeah. your film is gone. Yeah. You're like, I guess can't do that. I mean, you just can't. It's expensive, and it's a different thing, and it also has a certain kind of, you know, permeability, like it happens and then it's done and you can't redo it. You know, like it's film, you can't erase it. You just have mm-hmm. to keep going, even if it was a hot mess. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd say, you know, being able to do that, being able to take more chances is a really big difference. I mean, I used other digital cameras right after that, but they weren't the Canons. It was like, you know, some Sonys with like these lettuce adapters where you could put like SLR cameras on these sort of funky video cameras to make them look like SLRs before the SLRs came out.
Right.
And so I did that, and then we moved on to SLRs, and it was the 7D or the 60D or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And now it's the 5D, but then, you know, I started making so many videos, I started attracting some pretty interesting collaborators. And, you know, Bryce Fortner, who's the cinematographer, director of photography on Portlandia, approached me, and he made four of my videos with me and shot my short film. Bradley Sellers, who used to shoot Curb Your Enthusiasm and Mr. Show, he lives in town, and he approached me, and, you know, he shot my last music video and also a second camera on my short film. I mean, these are some badasses.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like, and there's more. I mean, this town is amazing for quality crew folk who want to live here and have the quality of life that comes with Portland. So
right.
You kind of clean
up. Which
is a
huge differentiator from somewhere like LA, I'm sure.
Well, it's funny. I talked about this, I think, yesterday, maybe even the day before, and because I was at POW Fest all weekend, you know, it came up a lot. People were asking me, as one of the few Portland filmmakers that was there and who I spent a lot of time there just meeting people and wanting to watch films. I'm really, you know, I wanted to immerse in it. They were asking me, so, you know, LA to Portland, what would you say the difference is if you're in the film business? And I was like, well, and I've had this conversation with other people who do what I do or think supporting what I do. I think that Portland is a great town for creatives, especially for people like me, directors, people with vision. And you're going to have, in a way, more chance of succeeding, I hope, in theory, than in LA, where everybody thinks they're a director and a writer. Uh-huh. Here, you really have to be recognized. You can say it, but nobody really cares. In LA, people are like, oh, is that what you are? I'm going to try to hobnob with you. And nobody, you know, people sort of care, but it's like a dime a dozen. You know, you can throw a penny and hit 50, like, director writers, and you don't really know who's for real. Right. Where in Portland, if you're living here and you're making work, which is really the hallmark of, you know, calling yourself what it is that you do, mm-hmm. if you're making work, you know, people are excited. And I think because I have made work and I continue to make work, it attracts folks to me, whether it's the work itself or, you know, the crew to support the work. And I'm in a better position because of that. At the same time, it's a slower crawl. You know, and it is a lifestyle choice for me and for my career. And sometimes there's moments where I wish I was in a bigger city to get bigger jobs and bigger mm-hmm. opportunities. And, you know, I'm a very, like, organic sort of opportunity person. I am ambitious, but at the same time, I really value who I'm working with. So I don't cast the net that wide. But I hope that, you know, I continue to attract really good people and good opportunities. But I would say LA, you know, conversely, it's just everybody goes there to pursue a dream, quote unquote. And the nature of that is really difficult, because when you have a lot of people pursuing a dream and really very little talent on that level, you know, until you've gotten to a certain point, it's just so competitive. It's disheartening. Mm-hmm. You know, a friend of mine who's a wonderful graphic designer, Sarah Gottesdiener, we just had breakfast yesterday, and she just moved to LA and was like, oh my God, you know, it's tough. And she's extremely talented. I think you have to find your pocket of people and then it gets better. And here, I think creative people just want to talk to each other. We all spend so much time in the dark that when we get into the light, we're like, hey, what do you do? Oh, that's cool. And if they relate to it and are excited about it, the next thing you know, you might be working with them. I mean, I just love that. Mm-hmm. And it's for real. And if they're here, they're probably pretty good. I mean, they've chosen to live in Portland, which is half the battle. It takes mm-hmm. cojones and ovaries to get that shit done.
Now, I have to ask you personally.
Yes.
First work of yours that I saw that I was conscious that it was you was the piece you did for Bob Mould.
Oh, yeah.
How did that come about that you worked with Bob Mould?
It's so funny. Ironically, I've been talking to him and his manager over the past couple of days about doing another video for him.
Oh, yeah, because there's another album out, right?
I know. Let's talk about that at the end. I can't say much because it's not 100%. But, well, when I was booking Doug Fir, I met Bob, and we became friends. I just loved him. We got along really well. I think, mm-hmm. you know, he's a sweet bear, and he's badass, talented musician, mm-hmm. and I don't know, all those things worked out, and we just became buddies, and you know, we became Facebook friends also. it's totally weird, right? Bob's on Facebook, you know, and it's just a normal person, and he really is a normal guy. And, you know, we stayed in touch. He was a fan of what I was doing at Doug Fir, and, you know, he sent me his book when his book came out, which was, I thought, was just the sweetest thing in the world. And he, I think, just honestly paid attention to my career and what I was doing and the work that I was putting out. And, you know, did I do another video for Merge? My brain is flopping. I keep thinking maybe I did. But at some point, Lindsay, like, I had been in touch with Lindsay at Merge, and I said, just remember, like, put my name out there if people want to make videos. I really want to do stuff because I worked with Merge in distribution and at the clubs. I was lucky enough to at least know a couple people there. Mm-hmm. And when the time came for Bob to make a video, I think they threw a bunch of names at him, and he was like, her, I know her. I want to make a video with her. And I like Portland. Alicia, let's do it. And so, like, within 24 hours, their camp, they really, they just got to go for it. Within 24 hours, they contacted me, sent me the record, told me what he was thinking, like a real basic kind of, a man goes to the woods and kind of gives up on society. That was the one sentence that he's like, that was my inspiration for writing the song. I was like, oh, he talked about building a log cabin. I was like, well, we can't really afford a log cabin for the budget that that you're giving us, but we can definitely afford some kind of shack with found twigs.
Some kind of shelter.
Kind of shelter. Like, if you can be flexible and it can be natural and you're not building a log cabin, I think we're onto something. And so I wrote a treatment, like, literally, I think Lindsay contacted me that morning. I wrote a treatment by 4 o'clock that afternoon, sent it off to her, and then it was approved within a day. And then we shot the video 3 weeks later. I mean, it was just crazy, that video. But, you know, it was amazing. And he's such a trooper and such a good sport. We had so much fun. And I love the way that video came out. And we were looking yesterday, it's gotten like over a quarter, or like around a quarter of a million views, which mm-hmm. for Bob, I think is fantastic, and had a nice Pitchfork premiere. And it was great for him. It's been a success for him, I think. And it's cool because it is artistic, and yet it's really visceral at the same time. And, you know, I love that. He really gave it his all. And he's like, I can't act. I was like, Bob, you can act. You don't even know you can act because you're on stage. You have this sort of seamlessly integrated stage persona and, you know, person. You are one person. You're such a beautiful whole human being. But he really, you know, he can throw down. I mean, he can just whatever you need. So I'm excited.
Is this when I was, you know, researching?
Googling.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid of what you found, Raymond. What did you? There's some strange. I'm a little. You know. I've been around for a while.
I was curious about the my summer as a goth project.
Oh, I'm no longer working on that.
Okay.
Yeah. So nothing to say there. You should just cut that out of the interview.
Okay. Sure, I can.
But there are other projects in the future we could talk about.
Okay. Well, why don't you throw one of those out at me here?
Well, we're talking about developing the short film I just made, The Gift of Gravity, into a feature.
Okay.
And turning that into a full-length project, which I think it would lend itself well to, mm-hmm. Because the nature of the 15-minute short that we made kind of almost ends at, like, the beginning of a much longer story. So okay. We'll see what happens with that. I'm also working on developing a fine art photo series that I did in 2009 into either a short film or a feature film, and that's called Fairy Tales. I've been, like, working on it since that point, but I've gone back and forth because of the miserable hellhole of pop culture fairy tale crap that's out there, and trying to figure out if what I'm trying to say is, you know, what I need to say given the landscape. And anyways, we'll see if that... How that
when you refer to the landscape, you're talking about, like, the prominence of, like, vampire things.
The vampire stuff aside, fairy tales and vampires are two separate things, thank God. But it's more like, you know, Grimm or Once Upon a Time all the horrible movies that are never good. Like, the, you know, Little Red Riding Hood with that horrible AstroTurf. I saw that movie.
Yeah,
there was AstroTurf in it. You know, like, just all these things that the canon of sort of fairy tales as inspiration got really hot in Hollywood for a while, mm-hmm. and then kind of went away, and it comes back and goes away. And my story is really not about any of that anyways. It's about, you know, a little girl figuring out, you know, how to be sort of getting control of her life when her home life is becoming increasingly more sort of difficult. And, you know, how she kind of pulls herself together and gets herself through it by learning things that are really in her imagination. But in the film, we see what that is. So that's what I've been working on that side. And then, you know, I'm really trying to continue to build a commercial career as a photographer mm-hmm. and a director. So I work on commercial projects as often as I get my hands on them, and, you know, photo projects, doing rebrands for people's websites, et cetera, things like that. I just did a whole rebrand photo project for a really amazing Portland company called Gemisphere. They do therapeutic gemstones.
Hmm.
You know, taking
never heard of them.
They're amazing. And taking pictures of pretty gems is just like, I'm cool with it.
Oh, nice.
It's really fun. So lots of fun things in the future. We'll see. I mean, after making one narrative film, I'm like ready to make a million more, and I'm desperate to get involved with a feature project, whether it is I write it or I work with a writer and a producer. You know, I've had a few opportunities that have come my way that haven't worked out. It's the nature of the beast with this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm optimistic that the work that I do will appeal to other people who might not be able to do what it is that I do, and then there could be collaborations. And I think that that's been probably my biggest illumination. I love writing, but I like working with people and helping making stories better sometimes more than I like writing completely on my own. I'm still kind of learning about myself as a writer.
Huh.
And this year I kind of dedicated myself to finding and developing some stories and some ideas that maybe I didn't write or I didn't come up with, and finding a way to collaborate with writers. I think that would be really fun and would take a little pressure off me after what I went through with the short.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I'm going to continue writing my own project, but I really want the fun of working with people, because I don't know how it is for you, but sometimes working in a vacuum is just no fun.
Collaborations are the most fun part of the job for me, for sure.
It, right?
Yeah, especially when you're working with, like, when we do websites with a really smart team that has a designer on board there,
yeah.
Then the idea is like 10 times better, you know?
Yeah, because someone's thought about it and they thought, oh, this could be fun, but I don't have the skills to execute, mm-hmm. you know, this bigger picture. And
exactly.
That's exactly how I am when I occasionally, you know, get the chance to work with writers or even creative from an ad agency, which happens occasionally. I've done a few sort of web form commercials for AT&T, and mm-hmm. they'll come to me with, which is crazy, right? Like, mm-hmm. But this is how we do it. How do you make a living? This is called mm-hmm. the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you have a job doing this? Everybody asks me that. They're like, can you make a living doing this?
That's a great point. That's what the job means. I've been looking for a meaning for that.
Well, no, I guess it's not what it means completely. I'm just saying you have to wonder.
No, I that is a theme that runs through this show a lot. And now I did want to ask you, A Gift of Gravity,
mm-hmm.
if you were to take that and develop it into mm-hmm. a full length, is there anything, and I know it's just premiered, but is there anything that you would want to do differently with the part of the story? Would you need to tell it differently to make it part of a larger narrative?
There are absolutely things that I would shift, and I would probably tool and condense. And yeah, I mean, I tried to put a lot into the short in order to sort of, and also I took a lot out is the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably what would come back in, because there's so much character development for pretty much all of the characters in my mm-hmm. initial shooting script and what we shot. What I originally edited, or what me and my editor, because I work with a really wonderful editor, we do work together, it was over 26 minutes, and then we got it down to 15. So you can see, even right in there, there was so much we took out, so much about these characters we had to take out, just to deliver kind of at its essence this story that would be palpable, or not palpable, palatable to a film festival audience, or it's even a web audience. I think there's a lot of mistakes when you're a young filmmaker you can make by having there be too much exposition, too many supporting storylines. When you're dealing with a short film, my experience is just to like get it out there, get the message out there, don't be precious, move on. So if I had the chance to turn it into a feature, I would absolutely be able to, I mean, there'd be character development for all the characters. You know, really I spent most of the film kind of giving it to two characters and then having everything else support those two characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a short film, that made the most sense to just keep the viewer's attention. Where in a feature, I can get the chance to stretch out a little bit and really like look at each of these girls and how their decisions and how their lives and how their personalities and how they relate to the world reflects their decision making, and that's something that you get a taste of in the short film. You see their faces. You're like, oh, that girl is really the moral compass when you see it, because you see it in her face and you see it in the acting. But I didn't spell it out in the short. I made it be something that you have to kind of just figure out, which I think is a good thing for a short film.
Mm-hmm.
But in a feature, you know, after the film, my short film ends is when the story really begins. what do these girls do? You know, after they've created this video of this friend and they've had this sort of hearkening moment with her, mm-hmm. you know? So it would be fun to get to really expand on these characters and, you know, be able to create something that's dark but also light and give the main character or one of the main characters who sort of suffers the darkness, give her a chance to shine and be light. You know, and who is she beyond that moment? I think mm-hmm. it's something that I hope when people see the film, that's what they're wondering. They're like, who are these girls beyond this moment? Because, you know, one of the comments I got, which was honestly the highest compliment I could get from some folks who talked to me after the film, was that they felt that all the performances were supernatural. And they were just super curious about who these girls were after seeing it because it felt like they were there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, man, okay, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It would be fun, though, to spend some time developing those characters and a story that was compelling and maybe, you know, fine-tuning it. I mean, you make a short film, I kind of think initially I thought it could lend itself to a longer story, but I also wanted it to be concise so that the viewer in short form would still be invested and would leave wondering, but not be given everything.
Right. Do you are you like a super fan of anyone? Like who would you love, like a dream partner, whether it's a writer or a filmmaker, musician?
God, I'm a fan of so many filmmakers. God, what would be, I'm so bad at these questions. These particular questions, I'm like, there's a thousand of them. I mean, I'm a fan of Spike Jones. I thought Herb was really great. At the same time, it was a little precious for my taste. It's tough. You know, I love, you know, it's old now, but I love the John Hughes canon. I think that, you know, there's something wonderful about his style, about sort of there being this kind of thread of like teenage cynicism and sort of helplessness and humor all within the context of that, which mm-hmm. I loved. You know, I'm a big fan of Guillermo del Toro and, you know, stuff that's even more in the sci-fi realm. You know, like it's interesting. My tastes kind of go all over the place. Writer-wise, God, I mean, I did make a couple videos with Neil Gaiman, and he did say that I could try to develop one of his short stories into a short, which I've thought about. So that could be really interesting at some point. I've thought about that a lot. I love, locally, Lydia Yuknovich, who I think she's a genius. She's amazing. And of course, Chelsea Kane. Chelsea Kane and Chuck Palahniuk are all friends, but Lydia has like this point of view in her writing that is just such a wonderful combination of totally just screwed in the head and absolutely like brilliant teenage. She had this great book called Dora the Explorer. Or wait, it's not, I can't, I think it's just called Dora, not Dora the Explorer. That's for children. Dora a Head Case, that's what it's called. But this, she wrote this amazing characters, like this teenager who's just a mess, but she's so interesting. Of course, somebody, you know, has already optioned that. I'm also just an indie filmmaker. I mean, I can't really afford to option anything.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully at some point there'll be something where there's some kismet in that context. I would love to collaborate with a novelist or a writer who's interested in, you know, developing a screenplay from something that they wrote. That's kind of in my purview right now, is like a dream collaboration as just an experience for what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like, you know, I have collaborated on other projects where I have come in and helped rewrite feature length scripts and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was a really gratifying experience for me. So it would be nice to be able to do that for something I get to direct.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Are you going to go anywhere with the drums, or is that just a let some steam off?
My bandmate, Shauna Gore, in our little band White Widow, had a baby, and he's way cuter than her guitar. So, Elliot, I love you, but can we get you some headphones? I don't know. I mean, I love playing. Honestly, I would love to play with new people. Not that I don't love playing with Shauna, but she's busy with the baby. And, you know, I would love to play in a new band and just have fun with it. I like to sing and play together and write while I'm singing, mm-hmm. which is really, and playing, which is really just visceral and fun. It's like, it's improv.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll see. I mean, it's funny though, you know, I've had different creative focuses in my life. You know, mm-hmm. music was a big one for a long time. Photography, big one. Now I'm kind of transitioning, still photography, but more into directing. And, you know, it is a big job. And it's kind of taken my creative focus. So I tend to have one thing that's the big thing that I do, mm-hmm. and then other little things I just do for fun. So drumming is just fun, and playing music is just fun. It's a way to blow off steam now, where mm-hmm. directing, especially directing, photography is fun for me, but it's also a lot simpler. It's just me, maybe an assistant, and I get to edit all myself. It's simpler. With filmmaking, it's, you know, me plus usually between 10 and 50 people. And then the collaborations along the way are what add up to the final product. And I just love the crap out of that. You know, it takes me out of my hole, my basement, right. my dark Portland cave, and gets me into this really wonderful symphony of creativity with all these people who are just wonderfully gifted and talented. And, you know, I'm addicted. Mm-hmm. I think anybody who really, you know, who likes being the center of energy, especially, I don't call it the center of attention because it's not. The center of attention is actually what's on screen. It's not what's behind, but the center of energy is what I am drawn to in the position, because it's, you really get a hand in everything. You know, you get to oversee everything. And I love that stuff. I don't know what's wrong with me, Raymond, but I love it.
Is there anything that you can talk about you haven't mentioned that you're working on? It's coming soon from Alicia.
Well, I am working on a new music video for the lovely and talented Sarah Jackson Holman. She is just a wonderful artist here in Portland, and she has this awesome little dance number. And we did some shooting last month at the coast at this incredible lighthouse, the Aquinahead Lighthouse, and also on the river. But we're probably going to do one more day of shooting in April when she gets back from tour, just to kind of balance out the story for everybody's needs. And then I am talking about maybe doing a new Bob video, but mm-hmm. can't quote me on that. Yeah, you can include it in here, but we'll see. Right. If everything goes well and I am doing it, by the time this finally comes out, I'll probably be casting for extras.
Yeah.
So, because if this idea that we're talking about happens, it's sort of insane and absolutely plays on my entire history of working in record stores. I will just leave it at that.
Okay.
But we'll see. And then, you know, honestly, trying to develop the gift of gravity, try to pursue the gift of gravity in film festivals, potentially developing that into a feature. And there's been other people who've been talking to me here and there about other film projects and feature projects. I am just open to hearing what people have to say. I want to work my ass off this year. So I guess we'll see.
That's excellent. On that note, Alicia, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Absolutely, Raymond. Thanks for having me on the job.
I also wanted to mention that we're going to be at the Specialty Coffee Association of America event in Seattle, right?
Yeah.
In theory, Candace and I will both be there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We'll be there all weekend, so be sure to catch us, ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. But in all seriousness, I don't know... the whole impetus for going was, well, A, that we work with a lot of clients in the industry. Mm-hmm. We love the industry. I have a ton of work experience in the industry. It's the only thing I know besides what I do
coffee.
Now. Coffee, yeah.
In the industry.
Well.
Sounds so serious.
But also, because we have that espresso machine here, which mm-hmm. we pulled our fabulous shots with, so yeah. I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'll get a little... And get a little barista 101. I have no
idea.
There
is a... Are you going to the... There's a six-hour class on pulling shots.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't... Their website is so confusing. Hint, hint. I cannot for the life of me figure out how the hell... How the fuck do you... Do you have to register for that? Do you just show up?
I think you have to register for it. Yeah, I was taking a look. I'll send it to you. You probably don't know all that, though.
No, I don't
know
anything.
Having owned a coffee shop in the past, you've had coffee shops. You were a barista.
Yeah, but I'm a little rusty. Yeah. I the last time I was a barista for a living was... however old, 10 years plus one. There was like a year in between. But I mean, you know, I saw 11 years since I've pulled a shot... For money.
Right. Never for money, Ray.
Now we'll find out if she's listening. Everyone, so the podcast is, it's not quite to number one yet on the iTunes store. So I'm just asking everyone who's listening to please tell like 500 people, 500 of your best friends, to listen to the job. We're in iTunes. Although it's kind of hard to find. I could have probably chosen a more distinctive name. Probably if you search for Need More, you're more likely to find it than The Job, since there's now TV shows called The Job and podcasts about finding a job called The Job.
Nice.
Oh, well. You know, what are you going to do?
You're going to get to number one, even with that name. Remember when we had to beat Needmore, Pennsylvania for ranking for Needmore?
Yeah.
We worked really hard at that.
Did we do it?
Eventually, yeah. I'm not sure now. I should check again. It was one of those things we tried really hard at, like, right when we started. Now.
Pennsylvania.
Now that we've taken over the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. See you next week.